Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, how one of the biggest Colorado River water users plans to conserve hundreds of thousands of acre-feet of water.
And the downside of crowdfunding to pay high health care costs.
But first, Arizona voters will decide the fate of the Secure the Border Act this November. It would make it a state crime to cross the border illegally, giving local officers the power to enforce federal immigration law. The controversial measure is modeled after Texas's SB 4 and hinges on that law's fate in the courts. Immigrant advocates have railed against it, saying it harkens back to Arizona's divisive SB 1070, which was largely found unconstitutional and evoked outrage when it was passed more than a decade ago. But the political mood around immigration is very different today than it was then, and so is the reality at the border. Earlier this summer, President Biden issued an executive order severely restricting asylum requests at the border when numbers surge. Now, unless a migrant tells a border agent that they fear for their lives, they're processed and deported. Since then, there has been a major drop in the number of people requesting asylum at the southern border, 50% since June. But our next guest says he doesn't believe it's entirely because of the president's executive order. David Rhodes is the sheriff of Yavapai County and president of the Arizona Sheriff's Association. He told me he looks to Mexico to find out why the numbers have changed so dramatically.
First of all, President Biden had been arguing for a few years that he did not have the authority. Only Congress had the authority to act on these changes to the asylum process. And so suddenly he decides that he does have the authority to act. So what we're not hearing, what we're not being told, and I think what the people of Arizona need to understand is that Mexico is playing a large hand in restricting the number of border crossers, which we've always needed them to do, but they're doing it now. So why is that leading up to the presidential election? Well, this is a major topic leading into the presidential election. You're seeing both candidates take positions and, you know, posturing towards immigration, border security. So what assurances do we have that when that election is over, it's not going to be back to business as usual? We still don't have the resources that we need to secure the border. We still don't have the resources that we need to fight fentanyl trafficking in our communities. We still don't have the resources that we need to fight human trafficking. All these illicit economies that were fomented by these open border policies, and you're seeing one stat, which is the number of border crossers, illegal border crossers that's being bantered about, which is largely attributed to the government of Mexico.
Well, let me ask you something about that real quickly. We should say, first of all, that President Biden's executive order on this is being challenged in court. But I mean, most of the people who have been coming across and causing these big spikes in numbers have been asylum seekers, people who are coming across and presenting themselves for asylum. So does it not make sense that with this executive order severely restricting that, when they cannot do that and they will be sent back, you're going to see those numbers drop?
No, not necessarily, because if you've just spent weeks or months traveling across the globe to get to the southwest border and suddenly you are not going to be able to get your asylum hearing or your chances have been greatly diminished, that just pushes people to the illegal ports of entry, the holes in the fence, the desert, the different places. And I think that that's what people need to understand. So how is it that these people are being taken away from the border on the southern side? Who's doing that?
All right. I want to talk about the Secure the Border Act with you. This is going to go to voters in November. It'll be on the ballot, referred by the state legislature. It would make it a state crime to cross into Arizona from Mexico anywhere other than a port of entry. So I want to understand how it is that as the law enforcement here, you would approach a law like this should it be, you know, approved by voters. There are questions about how this would be enforced. It sounds like someone, a deputy maybe, would have to see someone crossing illicitly or not at a port of entry, right, in order to arrest that person under this law. Is that how you understand it?
That is how I understand. That's how I believe the law is written. You need probable cause. It gives local law enforcement, the sheriff's deputies, the ability to make that arrest and detention that they don't currently have right now. Now, to have probable cause that somebody crossed the border illegally, you need to actually see them cross the border, right, or technology that's on the border needs to have detected them, or there needs to be some tangible evidence. Maybe they're out in the desert and they've been encountered by sheriff's deputies out in the desert, and there's footprints that go back to a hole in the fence, or they are nowhere near a legal port of entry. This is not written to give local law enforcement the ability, authority, and nor does local law enforcement have the desire to go into communities away from the border and start looking for people that are in the country illegally. The opposition to this law is people did not want it to be weaponized against people in communities.
Right. Like racial profiling in that way. Yeah.
And law enforcement, I can tell you, the Arizona sheriffs are 100% opposed to this law being used that way as well.
So let me ask you about the logistics of that. Like, are you planning, if this law passes, to be, you know, patrolling the border, patrolling these desert regions in between ports of entry? Is that something you already do? Would you need to work in coordination with federal authorities as you do that?
Well, and I'm speaking on behalf of the border sheriffs. You have four border sheriffs, and each sheriff would have to make their own decision as to, you know, how they were going to enforce the law. The law is written to be permissive. It doesn't require local law enforcement to enforce it. It says that they may enforce this law. Now, right now, there's no appropriations, funding, resources dedicated to this.
Right.
And I myself and the rest of the Arizona Sheriffs Association, were highly critical of the legislature for failing to appropriate funding with this as part of the bill. So our position has been this. This is on the ballot now because, you know, we know that the people of Arizona, they want a voice and border security. They are unhappy with the fact that, you know, government has failed them in this way. Government has not come through, not secured the border, not protected the public, not appropriated the resources. So people want their own voice in it. If the people of Arizona choose to pass this bill and write it into law, then the Arizona legislature and Governor Hobbs, the Arizona sheriff, submit to them that this is a mandate by the majority, and we expect the legislature and the governor to appropriate the necessary resources to carry out the mandate of the majority.
So it's about resources. Like, as it stands, you could not carry this out with the resources your department has.
Very, very limited.
What would that require in terms of resources? What are you asking for from the governor in that scenario?
Well, like I said, each sheriff on the border would have to make a decision as to what they were asking for. However, I can assure you that more sheriff's deputies would be the top of the list, and that everything that goes with more sheriff's deputies, like vehicles, like the ability to incarcerate, you would probably need to add the ability to prosecute. You would need to add public defenders. There would be courts that would need to be added. There would be a lot of things that need to be added. And look, all this stuff was in the border bill that was not passed.
Mm-hmm.
And the $17 billion that, you know, some of that was not going to good uses, in my opinion, or whatnot. But this is due to the inaction of multiple presidents, multiple Congresses, both parties in power have failed on epic levels to do what needs to be done to get the border secured. And so the Secure the Border Act, I would not submit that it's a silver bullet for the state of Arizona. I would say that the citizens of Arizona are just absolutely exasperated with the lack of federal action.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Yavapai County Sheriff David Rhodes joining us, also the president of the Arizona Sheriff's Association. David, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk this through.
Well, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Earlier this month, the biggest user of Colorado River water in the West agreed to conserve up to 700,000 acre-feet of water through 2026. The Imperial Irrigation District in California manages about 70% of that state's share of Colorado River water and says it'll be able to leave that amount of water in Lake Mead in what it's calling a landmark conservation agreement with the federal government. With me to explain how it'll work is Tina Shields, water manager at the Imperial Irrigation District. And Tina, how exactly are you going to do this?
Sure. And it's a little more complicated because we actually have to conserve the water before we can leave it on Lake Mead. We can't simply cut our water order. But we have three primary means of conserving that water for this particular federally funded program. And we are going to focus on two of those measures. The first is the expansion of our on-farm conservation program. This is a program where we provide financial reimbursement to growers who implement field level conservation measures. So they install drip irrigation systems or sprinkler systems or tailwater return systems, or for some of the fields, precision leveling, if you tilt fields a little bit one way or the other and slow down that water so it can be more uniformly applied, you can use less water and ideally increase your crop yield. The second program that we'll have that will generate the bulk of the water will be a deficit irrigation program, also kind of a mini fallowing program. So growers that farm alfalfa, Klein grass, and Bermuda grass can actually not irrigate for a 45 to 60 day period in the summertime. The crops will come back once that period is over and they reseed and re-irrigate, but they will use less water during that time period when evapotranspiration is very high and the yields are not the best quality of their year-round farming. And in exchange for that, we will offer a conservation payment because they will not be able to harvest a crop and get revenue from that crop.
Right. Are you confident that you'll have the buy-in from farmers in the Imperial Valley to meet this goal in terms of conservation?
I was a little nervous at first. Our backstop conservation program that we hope not to use is full year fallowing, and that's very devastating to our community. But we just initiated our first deficit irrigation program, and we had overwhelming participation by growers. They have embraced that. It's also a time period when the ag markets aren't as strong as they are in some years. And so based on that success and their interest in expanding their on-farm conservation measures, I'm pretty confident that we will meet the 700,000 acre foot goal.
How sustainable do you think these kinds of programs are? You mentioned it's federally funded. So once that federal money runs out, is this something that you think you can continue to do in some capacity?
So this is what we call a voluntary compensated short-term program. And frankly, there are some downsides to this. Our agricultural runoff feeds the Salton Sea, which is the largest inland body of water. And as our farmers get more efficient or irrigate less, that body of water gets smaller. We are very confident that because this is only a three-year program that we can manage this, but we are definitely not committing to do this for the long term. Our challenge is in the Imperial Valley that we only have one water supply, and that's the Colorado River. So if that system crashes and isn't viable over the long term, we basically have to move.
So yeah, over the long run, I mean, what do you do? Because it sounds like if you take the path that you're on now, that's not great for other environmental entities nearby. But if you don't encourage conservation or take other steps, as you say, you're going to have to move because the Colorado River is going to continue to see water levels dropping. So like, what's the long-term plan?
So it's a collective problem. All of the states and agencies that use Colorado River are going to have to step up. As I mentioned, the Imperial Irrigation District is already conserving and transferring about 16% of its water supply. This additional water over the three-year period will increase that annual percentage to between 22 and 25%. So there's really not much more we can do without reducing farming. And that is not something our district will entertain. Certainly, we can't fail in this endeavor, so we will keep plugging ahead until we find a way to make this work.
Given the importance of agriculture in your part of California, and given the amount of water that agriculture tends to use, are you looking at trying to make farming more water efficient? Are you thinking that like programs like this with maybe money coming from elsewhere where you can pay farmers not to farm at particular times of year or farm particular crops is the answer? Like, it's not like you have a lot of residential water use that you can easily cut back, or municipal water use. Like, a lot of it's agriculture, which, as we know, uses a lot of water.
Well, within California, certainly 97% of the water use at Imperial Irrigation District is agricultural. When people say that, it kind of rubs me the wrong way, because while urban people have their landscaping issues they're going to have to deal with and, you know, not have lush green lawns in the middle of the desert, which is what traditionally has been sort of the California story, people also like to eat too. And so I think it's really important that we continue to generate the food and not characterize that as an ag usage, because at the end of the day, the markets are all urban. And I think we have to collectively work together. There's going to have to be more water recycling. We're going to have to look at augmentation projects. I would never be a proponent of full-scale fallowing, but this deficit irrigation program, where it's a temporary short-term measure, might provide some viable solutions, particularly when the agricultural markets aren't that strong, because it's a little easier then for the farmers to partake in them, and it helps their businesses as well.
So, how applicable do you think what you're doing in the Imperial Valley might be to places in Arizona?
I think there's a lot of opportunities, and I will say it is going to be challenging. When the Imperial Irrigation District entered into its transfers in 2003, and we actually had some already in implementation for the prior decade, it was tough. We didn't want to do it. Our board voted against it a couple of times until we had the strong arm of the federal government on us and made a business decision once the environmental issues were taken on by the state of California, that fighting the federal government in court every year was not a long-term viable solution. But transfer partnerships that provided funding were realistically something we could do. We're all in a better place now. They are pretty challenging to implement, but I think there's lots of opportunities within other states to try it out and see how it works for their area and have the successes that we've had with participation from growers.
Do you get the sense that the farmers in your district are looking at some of the things they're doing now as long-term solutions, even if, it doesn't necessarily come from IID, but, things like using different kinds of watering methods or maybe, fallowing their fields temporarily, for a month or two here or there. Like, are those things you imagine that they're interested in continuing past 2026?
Yeah, the full year fallowing is tough. There's been some irrigation districts that have focused solely on that, and it's been pretty devastating to their communities. Our challenge for our community, and I think this is pretty normal for a lot of rural communities, is one in every six jobs is directly related to agriculture. So when you start farming less, there's this ripple effect through the community. And some of those irrigation districts that have not had in their portfolio of conservation opportunities the field level conservation, so they can farm. Continue to farm the same crops or maybe different crops using less water, they've seen a lot of those devastating community impacts. So that's our goal, is to avoid those. But again, partnership moving forward, what can we do that has the minimal impacts on farming and minimal impacts on our community, but still continue to yield conservation and crop at the same time?
Sure. All right. That is Tina Shields, water manager with the Imperial Irrigation District. Tina, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, what it takes to keep a book club running for nearly a decade.
But first, travel and tourism have been big industries in the Phoenix area for decades. Visitors from the East Coast or Midwest have headed to the Valley looking for something different or maybe just some sunshine. We're exploring the history and future of resorts and the Valley as a resort community in a series called Last Resorts. To do that, we're traveling from Paradise Valley to Litchfield Park, visiting some of the Valley's oldest and newest resorts and hearing how they've impacted the region from art and architecture to how people all over the world view the West.
From all over the world come visitors to relax and rest in the sun-drenched desert of Arizona. Dude ranches, great resort hotels, inns.
Scottsdale is delightful and clean and new.
Phoenix, a simply splendid city. Don't worry for a minute about a place to stay.
There is a ruggedness here, a loveliness here, that combines into a package of colorful memories. History, wildlife, entertainment, grandeur, they're all here awaiting you on your Arizona holiday.
And today we're going back to the early part of the 20th century, when a stretch of Van Buren Street was the place to stay. At its peak, my next guest says there were up to 200 hotels and motels, mostly clustered between 16th and 40th Streets, although they could go as far east as 52nd Street and as far west as about 11th Avenue. Steve Schumacher is the Phoenix Mayor's Office official historian. I met him earlier at Burton Barr Library to look at a collection of vintage postcards depicting many of these early hotels, and I started our conversation by asking when they started popping up along Van Buren.
Well, I think a little bit more of a backstory is that Van Buren has always been a very important road all the way back to the very beginnings of Phoenix. I mean, when Phoenix was initially surveyed and platted, the original town site, Van Buren was a northern boundary. But probably in the 1920s, when cars became more prevalent and more available, and price-wise, they were more affordable, that's when Van Buren really started taking off. Because in 1925, the federal government started taking over the highways, and they designated Van Buren as Highway 80, 89, 60, and 70 came a little bit later. And so those designations as highways brought people right down Van Buren, whether they were going north, they were going south, or they were going to California or back east. Those four roads converged and led people right through the heart of Phoenix starting in the 1920s.
That would seem to make Van Buren a natural place to put a place for people to rent a room and sleep.
Absolutely. It made sense, made total sense. It was kind of like Route 66 back in the old days.
So at what point would you say was the peak of maybe, you know, 150, upwards of 150 places to stay on this stretch of road?
Yeah. Well, I would say after World War II, I mean, after when World War II was going on, the whole Phoenix area, there was a lot of Air Force bases, and there was a lot of training, and soldiers came through. And so when the war ended and they got back to Des Moines, Iowa, or Omaha or wherever, and they said, I really don't like shoveling snow anymore. That was a pretty good couple of years in Phoenix. So they would come back, and the population boom, a lot of it happened because of that. And the same thing with the motels and the success of Van Buren. A lot of travel after World War II, people had cars and they were traveling cross country on their own. So I would say if you had to look for one specific period of time that really launched Van Buren, I would say right after World War II.
Well, to your point, people had cars, they had time, and they had money.
Right.
And they, many of them had been here and wanted to come back and at least visit.
Exactly. And then the federal government in the mid-50s, 55 or so, they created the interstate highway system. Dwight Eisenhower was president, and he wanted connecting roads. Some people think it was an escape route from the Cold War. Who knows? It may have been. But it put that in place to create the interstate highway system, and Van Buren was a big part of that.
So what did it look like? I mean, I'm imagining the stretch of Van Buren that you're describing with, you know, more than 100 motels. Like, was it just like motel after motel after motel on, next to each other on the street?
Yeah, pretty much. Pretty much. You can see some old photographs of, you know, they're trying to get the whole length of Van Buren. And that's exactly what it was. One neon sign after another. And the fact that there was anywhere 100, 150 motels of different sizes and prices and amenities created the need to differentiate. They had to come up with different gimmicks, so to speak. So that was that's what they needed to do. How do you catch a driver's eye coming down Van Buren at 25, 30 miles an hour?
So we have some postcards here of some of the motels on Van Buren. And I want to ask you first off about this collection of postcards, because the idea that motels would have postcards is not necessarily unique. I mean, a lot of places have them that you can send, but this is an astounding collection here.
It's amazing. Breathtaking, actually.
All right. So the first one that we have here is for a place called Autopia, a motor hotel and tourist court. I mean, it lists the highways. And looking, it's an aerial shot, this first postcard. It almost looks like what we think of now as a suburban master plan community.
It really does. I hadn't thought about that, but you're right. Well, this is one of the first lodging places in Phoenix. It was on Van Buren. It was built in 1929. And at that time, the idea was just to give people a place that was close to their home, wherever that was. So these had garages. They had like little kitchenettes. It was like a self-contained little building. And that was the idea initially.
So if this was built in the 20s, this must have been one of the first on Van Buren
that came
along.
It was one of the mass lodging draws, yes, on Van Buren, absolutely.
All right. So the next one is the Highway House. Yeah. Sleep is our business. And one of the things that's interesting about this one is there's a train on the property that apparently used to take guests to their rooms.
Yeah. Again, that train and the massive size of this was one of the, we talked about it early on. They had coffee, they had breakfast, and they had swimming pools. And then they had, this is an example where it was an entire resort spread out through a huge property. Del Webb built this. It was the very first of his chain of highway houses that he had around the country. So this was the very first one at about 32nd Street in Van Buren. And that train, yeah, it took people to their room. It was also provided entertainment for the kids.
So you mentioned how there were a lot of photos at the time taken of this area of Van Buren at night. What must that have looked like?
Oh, it was before my time, to be honest. But well, it's been characterized a lot like Las Vegas.
I was thinking of
the
gambling strip of Las Vegas with all the neon signs and the big buildings.
Exactly, that comparison has been made numerous times. They've even called Van Buren sometimes the Fun Set Strip. And it would be a lot like seeing the lights of Vegas for the first time, which, you know, I remember flying into Vegas at night for the first time and seeing the strip with all lit up like that. So Van Buren was probably not too dissimilar, where Vegas had probably a lot more high-rise places to stay. Van Buren was filled more with little bungalows in the early days. But yeah, from a neon sign standpoint, it's probably pretty similar to the strip in Vegas.
So at what point did this stretch of Van Buren stop being such a haven for hotels, motels, resorts, places like that?
Well, you know, Van Buren really took off when, well, the San Carlos and the Westward Ho and the Biltmore and the Camelback Inn, those were full-fledged resorts, pricey places. People would stay for weeks at a time. When Interstate 10 was completed, going through Phoenix, that was the death knell in the 70s of Van Buren. It started going downhill from there.
Because people no longer had to drive through Van Buren.
You didn't have to drive through on I-60 anymore to get to Los Angeles. You could use the I-10. But that was just one factor. I mean, the affluent people in Phoenix started moving north, you know, up towards the Biltmore and Arcadia. So where Van Buren had been the hub, not only of motels and downtown Phoenix and living, but it's like Park Central as a shopping mall kind of killed downtown shopping in Phoenix. It's the same thing. People started moving to the northern part of Phoenix. And so the combination of I-10 and people moving further north in town, that kind of signaled the end of Van Buren.
Steve Schumacher is the Phoenix's mayor's office official historian. We'll post photos of some of the postcards at theshow.kjzz.org. And next Tuesday, in our next installment of Last Resorts, we'll find out how Scottsdale's tourism industry got started and visit one of the city's mid-century resorts. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Crowdfunding is everywhere these days. People raising money for causes they believe in, to start a business, to meet an idol, or most often to pay for healthcare costs. From raising money to pay for cancer treatment, to helping someone pay for unattainable medical bills, to paying for research into a rare disease, raising money for healthcare has become so routine, a recent Atlantic article says doctors are sometimes recommending it. It says a lot about our healthcare system, according to our next guest. Nora Kenworthy is an associate professor in the University of Washington School of Nursing and Health Studies, as well as the author of Crowded Out: The True Costs of Crowdfunding Healthcare. I spoke with her more about it, beginning with how the issue first came to her attention.
I started looking at crowdfunding sites about 10 years ago. So this was quite a while before most people had heard of sites like GoFundMe. One of the earliest campaigns I came across was actually on a flyer, like a paper flyer posted to a telephone pole in my neighborhood.
Wow.
At that time, GoFundMe had so little kind of name recognition that one of the things they offered to fundraisers was that they could kind of print out their these sort of flyers of their campaigns with tear-off tabs at the bottom. But even at that early date, I was noticing that a very large proportion of campaigns that I was seeing on sites like GoFundMe were for medical needs and expenses.
Talk a little bit about how this works. Like, I think people are aware that they exist, but it's not like if you raise money on a site like GoFundMe, you will always raise enough to pay for what you need to pay for, or that you're going to get all of the money that people donate to you, right?
Yes. So sites like GoFundMe operate differently than sites like, for example, Kickstarter, right? So if you're fundraising on Kickstarter, you actually have to hit your goal in order to get your money. Mm. Whereas on GoFundMe, you get whatever people donate to you minus some fees and percentages that are taken out of donations. And sites like GoFundMe will encourage people to set a relatively low goal for their campaign. So, you know, even if I perhaps am facing a very significant out-of-pocket cost for, say, cancer care or something, you know, in the tens of thousands of dollars, if I do the kind of the steps of like how to set up a campaign on GoFundMe, it will largely tell me to set a pretty low goal of a couple thousand dollars. Hmm. And often that's because I think GoFundMe wants people to have a successful experience, right? And recognizes that most people who start campaigns on the site are not going to raise tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars. You know, most people can expect to raise, you know, maybe a couple thousand dollars, but a lot of people actually raise much less than that. So about 40% of campaigns raise $70 or less.
Wow.
You know, people see campaigns in their midst that are very popular, doing incredibly well. Those are the campaigns that we tend to see on social media and in the news. And it raises our expectations of what we can expect from the platform. And unfortunately, there are just a lot of people using crowdfunding right now. And often they are reaching out to networks of people like themselves who may also have a lot of financial insecurity and may have trouble donating significant amounts to their campaign.
Right, right. Talk about some of those blockbuster campaigns on sites like these. Like, there have been some really famous ones that people have probably heard of. And they're often also like often tied to major cultural moments, right?
Yes. I think the last one that went really viral for medical reasons was probably Mary Lou Retton's. Mm-hmm. So she was hospitalized and is a former Olympic gymnast, and her daughter started a campaign for her. It raised millions of dollars very quickly. Mm-hmm. But I think for a lot of people, it also raised questions about how is it that it often seems that, you know, people who already have a lot of social status or celebrity are doing most well on this platform. I think also it exposed Mary Lou Retton and her family to a lot of scrutiny about why it was that she needed to start a GoFundMe in the first place. And so in that experience, she's actually not alone. I talk to a lot of crowdfunders who say, you know, yes, I raised some money, but I also face these really hard questions or these kind of judgments from the crowd about why it was that I needed to do this.
So there's like a stigma aspect here, even when people turn to this very public form of crowdfunding, of raising money.
Yeah. And I think if I was going to extrapolate across, you know, thousands and thousands of campaigns that I've looked at, I would say one of the most common kind of emotional expressions that I see is one of shame. Mm. You know, people feeling ashamed about asking for help, ashamed that they maybe have gotten to that place in the first place. It's a common cultural phenomenon in the United States for people to feel a lot of shame about needing to ask for help, unfortunately. And most people who are asking for help on GoFundMe really are kind of asking because they have nowhere else to turn a lot of the time.
Right. So talk a little bit about your research on the other side of this, right, which is like what this says about the American healthcare system and people who even have insurance ending up in situations like this.
Yeah. So I think there's a couple of different things going on here. So first of all, you know, we do know that even for people who are insured, the costs of care when you get extremely ill or need extensive medical procedures often cannot be paid or afforded out of pocket. So oftentimes people are looking at, you know, bills of tens of thousands of dollars, if not hundreds of thousands of dollars. one of the other things is that, you know, because a lot of Americans have healthcare that's provided through their employer, when they get too sick to work, they then also lose their insurance oftentimes. And so I do see a lot of campaigns for people, you know, for example, who are going through cancer treatments and have suddenly lost their insurance because they've lost their job. Then there's this very substantial proportion of Americans who are either uninsured or underinsured, which means they don't have enough insurance to really cover, you know, crisis care, catastrophic care. And those people as well, you know, are being slapped with enormous bills. So, for example, I talk in the book with one woman who had a premature baby. And, you know, she and the baby had to be sort of life-flighted to a NICU because they were in a very rural area. And mm-hmm. she was looking at, like, bills of more than $1 million for her, wow. her baby's care. And that's not uncommon to see on sites like GoFundMe.
Wow. I wonder, like, do campaigns like this, do crowdfunding efforts for healthcare exist very much in other countries?
They do, but they're different. So I would say in countries that have better public health insurance systems than we do, so for example, Canada or European countries, there's still crowdfunding. There's less of it overall, and it tends to focus on things that are not covered by the public insurance system. So that might be more experimental treatments or non-traditional care, or people who are trying to get care faster than they're able to within the public system. But there's other, what I call market-driven healthcare systems like ours, for example, in China or in India, where crowdfunding platforms are thriving, in part because so many people need to turn to it for medical care.
Right. So let me ask you about that lastly here, which is the money side of this for these companies. Like, how much money does a site like GoFundMe make off of this? Like, what are the profits look like?
So it's really hard to tell. GoFundMe is a privately traded company. Most of what we have to go off of is their own statements about how much money has been raised. I think this year GoFundMe said that about $30 billion had been raised on its platform since 2010. Mm. So we're talking big money. But it's very hard to tell how much they raise from campaigns and also how they raise money from campaigns. So they ask for a tip from donors. They collect some money in fees from each campaign. But we don't know exactly, like, for example, how much money they make off of this vast trove of user data, for example, that they're sitting on, given how many hundreds of millions of people have used the site.
It's really interesting stuff. All right, we'll leave it there for now. Dr. Nora Kenworthy, Associate Professor in the University of Washington School of Nursing and Health Studies, author of the book Crowded Out, The True Costs of Crowdfunding Healthcare. Nora, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks for explaining this. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It was great to talk with you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Barbara Vandenberg has made a career out of her lifelong love of storytelling. She worked for years as an arts journalist at the Arizona Republic and as the books editor for USA Today. But her own story starts way back when she was a kid and spent countless hours in the comfort of a bookstore. As she got older, she came to realize that a bookstore with a bar can be extra comfortable. And that, she recently told the show's Sam Dingman, is how she ended up as the host of the First Draft Book Club at Changing Hands Bookstore.
They recognized me as a nerd.
Okay.
They were looking for their overly committed book nerd, yes.
Yes. So what made you fall in love with books originally?
I just deeply admire storytelling and storytellers. My mom would take me to the library sometimes literally every day. She would sit me down with a stack of books and we'd work through it together. And so she really, really encouraged me to be a reader.
So when you set out to begin this book club at Changing Hands, had you been in other book clubs?
I had not been in other book clubs. I had been an English major and I'd taken a lot of creative writing classes when I was in college. And part of the appeal of a book club was I deeply missed that dynamic of showing, like, I'm just such a dork. I wanted school to never end. I wanted to, and this was sort of like an extension of school as an adult. Like, you have your assignment, you've got the book that you've got to read, you've got to show up with your notes and participate in the classroom discussion. And I just really I felt like that was the only thing I was ever good at, was showing up for class with my book marked up and something to say. And so to get to continue that has been just a delight for me.
That's so interesting. I don't know that I had considered the idea that starting a book club could come from a place of almost nostalgia.
Yeah, I definitely think there's nostalgia to it. But also, I longed for that throughout life, to have this space where people are thinking about and talking about, you know, a piece of art or media in a critical, thoughtful way. It's hard to have an in-depth, kind of like structured conversation about, you know, the historical significance of the books, or the setting and the tone and the way that the book is written. People don't, in the wild, think and talk that way.
So you are given this golden opportunity to create a book club. How did you prepare for the first one? Like, how did you pick the first book?
So it was interesting. I had gone through kind of like a rough time. My mom died actually shortly before book club started. Mm. And I'd actually stopped reading for about a year. I could not finish a book. Changing Hands opened in Phoenix, and I had just started to dip my toe into reading again. And they asked me about the book club. And part of the reason I said yes was, okay, well, this will force me to read. And so the first book we chose just happened to be one of the first books I was able to finish reading, because that's all I had. And it was a book called The Descent by Tim Johnston. Fantastic book. It's a literary thriller. And part of the reason I was able to get through it is that it was just a page turner. And so that first one was literally just, this was the book I was able to finish in time, so we're doing this one.
Sure, sure. Did you find that your relationship to reading that book was different, having come back to reading after this experience of losing your mom?
Yeah, I mean, there was a healing quality to it, because it felt like I had lost books as well. Mm. And so I don't mean to sound goofy about it, but there was almost a spiritual component to it.
That doesn't sound goofy at all.
So yeah, it was really meaningful. And book club as a whole has been really meaningful. I still see it as part of that healing process, coming out of that deep depressive spiral.
Yeah. At that first meeting, or in other meetings since then, over these last almost 9 years now, did you speak at all about where you were personally as you were reading the book? Was that something you introduced as part of the discussion, or did you keep the conversation more focused just on the book itself?
I did talk about it. I remember we read one book, Imagine Me Gone by Adam Hazlett, which had a character who had deep depression and mental illness issues, and there were conversations about suicide and antidepressants and various medications that this character with depression was on. And so I believe in that conversation, I opened up pretty deeply about having experienced a depressive episode where I struggled with some of these things. And so, you know, I like to create an environment where people are not ashamed. I've had people in book club conversations talk about past childhood trauma or sexual abuse or domestic violence. I try to create a space where people feel safe.
Wow. So how do you navigate those moments in a book club meeting when things might go in a particularly harrowing or intense or sad direction? Do you allow that to go in whatever direction it seems to want to organically go? Or does there come a point where you feel like you have to try to steer things back to the book? What sort of active listening and facilitating are you doing in those moments?
Just creating a supportive atmosphere and listening is really, really important. It's an empathetic, caring group. And so when you let those organic moments sort of flower and take shape, it always creates something special. We always end up back, quote unquote, on track. But I feel like the reason we come to this space in person to talk about a book in a group together is for these kind of organic moments more than it's for about the book itself. Like, book club, so much of it is just about wanting and building community with other people There are people who were strangers when they came in, and now they sit at the same table every time, and they go out to dinner and they hang out outside of book club, and they wouldn't have met without that. So I think those sort of organic moments of opening up are really essential to creating those kind of friendships and that sense of community.
Sure. And, you know, I'm thinking of other social spaces where people come together around interests. And there's something about the emphasis on story, to go back to what you were saying at the beginning of our conversation, that seems like it makes people feel like it's a safe space to talk about the story that's in the book, but also a safe space for their story.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have a microphone, right? Like it's a large common space. We pass a microphone around so people will talk about their histories and their experiences in the world that are sometimes very painful, very private, into a microphone in front of a room of like 70 people. And it's a very vulnerable thing. So I take very seriously my job of creating a safe, welcoming space for people to be able to have those experiences, because I don't want anybody walking away from that feeling bad about it.
Boy, it barely feels like we're talking about a book club anymore.
Sounds like therapy now. But that conversation will organically develop if you get a bunch of smart, thoughtful readers in a room together to talk about a book in which those elements are at play. So it does just happen really naturally. You don't have to force it, and people don't feel like confronted or bummed out to have that conversation.
Yeah. Well, we have gotten very philosophical in this conversation about book clubs, and I appreciate it very much.
It is my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Barbara Vandenberg hosts the First Draft Book Club at Changing Hands Bookstore in Phoenix. The next meeting is tonight at 7 p.m.
You in any book clubs, Lauren?
You know, I was once, but I'm not great at finishing the books on time.
Oh, yeah, that would seem to be a requirement, huh?
It is. I got to get better at it. Yeah. Maybe next time.
Maybe next time. All right. Well, that'll do it for this Tuesday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening.
That's it for this episode of the show's podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, you can visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Lauren Gilger for Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.